Welcome back, everybody, to the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Hemming, and apologies for my croaky voice this morning. It's time for the irresistible force to meet the immovable object. Yep, that's right. It's Brexit negotiations. So as David Davis faces Michael Barnier and the hordes of negotiators across the big table in Brussels, we're joined for this show by Toby Baxendale, who's been on before. If you listen to Toby's earlier episodes, you'll know he is a big pro-leaver, so there'll be some pro-leave stuff in here, and maybe I'll challenge it a little bit, although I am a little one degree underish today. Anyway, enjoy the show. We recorded this on the Monday, which is the first day of Brexit negotiations. They haven't actually kicked off yet, but hopefully there's some interesting bits in there for you all. Please give us a shout back on feedback. You can find us on Twitter at Brexit Podcast and on Facebook as well. And we'd love to have some recommendations for future show guests. Until then, enjoy the show with Toby.
And welcome to the show, Toby Baxendale. Great to have you back on.
Thank you very much, Tim. A great pleasure.
Well, thank you. Yeah, thank you for joining us again, Toby. I guess my first question is, divorces, do they always get messy?
Well, I suppose in the majority they do, because the lawyers get involved, people start arguing, and the lawyers start arguing on very, very, very tedious points. So I suppose your analogy is what's going to happen today.
Yeah, well, we're recording on the Monday, and it's the historic day. It's the first day of Brexit negotiations. David Davis squaring up to Michael Barnier in Brussels. Now, this is actually comes out on Tuesday, so there's going to be a little bit of stuff happening today.
Right.
But yes, that is my question, and I am like everybody else in this situation. I'm intrigued as to what's going to happen.
Well, I think my personal take on it is she's going to go in there. The mandate from the electorate, I mean, paradoxically, is actually clearer than it's ever been before. It's a mandate to leave the European Union. Over 85% of the population voted for parties that wanted to leave the European Union. And by that, for clarity, that does mean the customs union and the single market. So she does actually have, I mean, a stronger mandate if you take it in the round, although her individual mandate is clearly impaired significantly. So it's going to be interesting, but unfortunately, these negotiations, you know, tend to be adversarial, and I just hope that the more measured heads in the room can get down to things that work in the best interests of both parties. That's what I've always found in any negotiations. If you can always focus on the things where you can both guarantee win on first, then you can get some good momentum into getting a good deal for both parties.
Yeah, we have a look at some of those points in a second. I mean, probably just to challenge you on that, Theresa May having a stronger mandate. I think, although all the parties would have, most of the parties have come out and said that they, en masse, would vote or majority would vote to leave, there would be a lot of people that were very pro-Remain who still felt that they were voting Labour. That was not their vote to leave the European Union. It was they were voting in the general election now on other issues.
Well, that's going to be very unfortunate, isn't it? Because I mean, they have factually voted for a party that's standing, and John McDonnell and their leader Jeremy Corbyn have made that clear, that it's for leaving the EU and respecting the people's wishes. I do hear what you say, and I feel a lot of people will be quite miffed as to why the Labour leaders will be coming out on a very strong leave basis when actually, again, ironically, their House of Commons leader on this, Keir Starmer, is for what he terms a soft, quote unquote Brexit, but something akin to a Norway or a Switzerland type deal. So
yeah,
there's confusion on that side, but I mean their manifestos were clear.
On the fact that the manifestos were clear, and I don't want to sort of trawl over old ground too much. I know things are moving so fast in the election now, was a couple of weeks ago, but does that mean that the Liberals really missed a huge opportunity here, because they were the ones that were coming out and saying that they were very much for the European Union, yet it really they didn't make the gains that they perhaps could have done?
Well, yes, Tim. I mean, in short, yes. And really, the Remain voters, if that was there, that actually, I think, has really focused it. It wasn't an election. She called the election for a stronger Brexit mandate, and I don't think she really got the Brexit issue debated correctly. Otherwise, you would have expected to see a much higher Liberal vote, because, as you said, a number of those Labour voters, even though their party leaders are not, are actually Remain supporters. So, yeah, it's terribly unfortunate for that great historic party.
Yeah, now let's move on to the talks. As you said there, that if you agree on the things you can agree on first, then that can put everybody in a better frame of mind. But the European Union have been quite clear that there's a few things they want done first before they sort of move on to things like trade agreements. So guaranteeing of EU citizen rights, border issues with Northern Ireland, I guess that would probably extend to Gibraltar as well, and then maybe a big fat divorce settlement as well. I've just dug into some figures. Fullfat.org says that in last year the UK government paid £13.1 billion to the EU, and EU spending on the UK was forecast to be £4.5 billion. So that was a net contribution from the UK of £8.6 billion. So you'd think that divorce settlement, they want quite a hefty sum.
Yes, well, that's to be debated. And I must say, I'm in agreement with our European partners that the first thing that you've got to do is you've got to have a square up of your historical affairs. We need to do that with good grace, as do they, because there are things we've paid for in advance. There are assets we own jointly that need to be settled in our favour, and there are obligations that we've signed up to that we need to pay for. And maybe some external auditors can get involved and deal with this in quite a dispassionate manner, try and take the heat out of it, try and take the politics out of it. It should be just a straightforward numbers auditing style calculation. It shouldn't be an emotional thing. On the people front, I mean, no person in the European Union should be treated as a political pawn, and I do think both sides recognise this. But I think the as opposed to giving unilateral citizenship, I think there are some issues there, as I understand. I think if you're a citizen of Denmark, you can't hold dual nationality. But we can give permanent residence to our European citizens here. Reciprocal rights respected for the Brits. I think that's a no-brainer. But I think the more difficult bits of the argument that will start rolling out are what rights do these European citizens have going forward? Because I think the European Community's line is to keep them to the rights that they would have under a European system, rather than what they would then have under a British system. So that again will create conflicts, and you've got to get into the detail of that. I don't think anyone knows until you're in the weeds trying to sort that out, how that will pan out. But there's a lot to agree on. Do you see what I mean? It's only when you get down to the final knockings, are there real nitty-gritty bits that you need to negotiate on? But I don't think there's anyone who's going to resist, permanent citizenship on either side for Brits and for EU nationals.
Yes, but then moving forward, if that's the case, it leans then towards a softer Brexit.
To me, there's only one Brexit. You vote to leave. It's a binary thing. You vote to leave the European Union. We've done that. If it means soft in terms of treating people fairly, then absolutely. I think anyone in their right mind will be in for a soft Brexit. But if you mean soft Brexit in terms of sort of having one foot in single into the customs union and one foot out there trading free trade, I don't think you can do it. You're going to get you're going to get pulled apart and it's going to be ugly. It's not possible.
Okay. Well, on that point then, and it's quite an unusual step, but the five UK business groups have put in a joint plea for the economy to be put first. And top of their list of demands is tariff-free trade of goods between the UK and the EU, minimal customs formalities at the border borders, and a flexible system for the movement of labours and skills. So, I mean, doesn't that contradict what you've just said in some ways?
In terms of what?
Or at least challenge in what you've just said in terms of the fact that that is not really Brexit at all.
Oh, it definitely could be Brexit. It depends what the European Union are prepared to negotiate. I mean, frictionless travel for goods and services of the supply chain. Well, you know, I think we discussed this on our last podcast. You do have $2 billion worth of stuff per day going backwards and forwards between Canada and America with no physical border. Yet they're two different jurisdictions. Now, if you fly to America, this might put it into perspective for you. As you know, you fill in the online ESTA form, do your all your bits and pieces online. That will be equivalent of doing all your custom documentation, and then it's actually a very quick whiz through the airport and customs at the other side. And that's how they do it for trade as trusted partners. Trusted partner status for people who are regular exporters and importers will get all these systems set up very quickly and very electronically and very, very efficiently. It's not like, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, it would be heavily paper-based and heavily manual and so on and so forth. I mean, that's how Norway and Sweden, they also work on that basis. So, again, it's not rocket science what we're looking at. It's nothing new. It's not a new challenge to the world. There's no reason why, sitting outside of the European Union, you can trade on that basis. Our business, or my fellow, you know, business people can trade on that basis, and that's what we should be looking for. Absolutely, and I agree with them in that respect.
From an EU perspective, though, if everything is set to be so simple from a trading perspective for Britain, does that not set a precedent for the rest of the members and other member states who might be wobbling in their own membership of the union?
Well, it might do, and I don't think that's a bad thing because, you know, competitive tension, you know, always produces, the end of the day, best performance. So, you know, the European Union has to earn its living, doesn't it? And it needs to be wanted and needed by its members. And if we're putting a little bit of pressure on that, I don't think that's a bad thing at all for the for the existing, you know, members in there, they should get the best out of it. Absolutely.
Do you see what other areas of the negotiations do you see being particularly thorny?
Well, that the people bit, that last little bit of the people bit, and in terms of the, you know, who gets what benefits once it's all sorted out, that's going to be contentious. And then the tariff element and. Obviously, I'm a free trader, so I want to see no tariffs. I'm against protectionism. That's why I'm against the EU, the protectionist bloc against the rest of the world. I think that's in a very aggressive and a very impoverishing position to be in. So I want to see all barriers removed. So I think it's overwhelmingly in the interests of the European citizens to trade on a free trade basis with Great Britain, certainly because they trade more with us. So hopefully rationality will carry the day. And I'm really hopeful that, you know, pressure from their own businesses out there who are trading with us and who own assets here will bang the drum of free trade and low tariffs, and that will benefit all of us. Every single citizen of Europe, be it a European Union citizen or a European citizen, will completely benefit, you know, from having no barriers. So that's got to be the goal to go for. That's got to be the start point, you know, for any British negotiation. And then if they're insistent upon erecting tariff barriers, then, you know, so be it. You know, we will end up using the World Trade Organization tariffs that China use with Europe, America uses with Europe, you know, Australia, ditto, another use with Europe. And that would be a great shame, Tim, for the Europeans and for us. But they, you know, as I said, they will be the net losers in all of this because they trade more.
Do you have confidence that David Davis is well prepared enough going into these negotiations and that they can see it through so that the UK does come out with some arrangement of substance?
Well, I have no inside track into David Davis, but what I do know is the Legatum Special Trade Commission. I'm a trustee of the Legatum Institute, which is an education charity, has been feeding from our special trade commissioners a lot of expertise into David Davis's department. And indeed, one of our special trade commissioners has been seconded as an advisor there. And these are guys who have negotiated or taken part in the negotiation of probably most major trade agreements around the world in the last 25 years. So, I'm hopeful that there is at least some specialist trade advice coming in on from that angle. I have no special insight into what's going on there.
Okay. Now, Toby, the Great Repeal Bill has a big part to play here. So can you describe exactly what that means for us all?
Yeah, so what the Great Repeal Bill does to me, I mean, this is really, really interesting. And in fact, it can only be the way, really, is it 1 minute before midnight on the day when we leave, you know, we have a certain body of law, of European law that's applicable into the United Kingdom. And then the Great Repeal Bill is actually incorporating all that entire body of law that we had 1 minute before midnight to make sure that 1 minute past midnight it's still there. So that's what that's doing. It's a very interesting mechanism so that we have exact continuity on day one. And then it's up to the parliament. Then it's up to the parliaments and the parliaments to come in the future. Because if I remember, it's either some ridiculous amount of laws, 17,000 or 19,000, something, some stupidly large amounts. Anyway, then you know, over a period of time, and you know, it may be over many decades. You know, British parliamentarians and different British parliaments will then decide which bits they're going to keep, which bits are applicable, which bits need fine tuning, modifying, etc. So it's actually a very, very small C conservative precautionary act to make sure that there's continuity.
Yeah, but isn't Europe mentioned sort of thousands of times within that? And just in terms of the amount of paperwork that has to be gone through to make it even make sense. You know, if we're no longer members of the European Union, and yet a lot of what's written in there relates to us being in the European Union. Does that not make it an error?
Yeah, so there is an argument that's saying, you know, the olive tree regulations, because as far as I'm aware, we have no commercial olive farms in the United Kingdom, should just be excluded on day one, period. Mm-hmm. And there's a number of those bits of legislation, which again should hopefully be quite easy to identify, fairly binary, and could be chopped off without anyone really even having debate about it. But then there's grey areas ones, and then there's the, you know, sort of absolutely cast iron ones, and that's going to be a process that Steve Baker, the MP for High Wycombe, is going to be in charge of in the Brexit department. As far as I'm aware, someone's got to lead that bill, and that's going to be down to that element of the department. So it's going to be a challenge, yeah, but it is actually moving all European law into ours post our departure.
Mm. And have we got time to do all of this? I mean, the clock is ticking on the 2 years, and every day there seems to be another either political scandal or worse, I suppose. It's sort of apocalyptic times in some way. So are we just going to simply run out of time?
Well, there's I hope not. Yeah, I think if the will is there on both parties, then no, because as I said, the great repeal bill is actually you can actually absorb everything in, because if it did apply, you know, 30 seconds previously, it applies to 30 seconds after midnight as well. And yes, there will be some inconsistencies that they can then start being dealt with after the act. And cleared up by courts of law if it gets to that stage, but hopefully it doesn't. Now, if it's at a stage where the actual negotiations haven't got to that stage, and that's a whole different ballgame, then I think paradoxically, from what I understand, is although we've triggered Article 50, which gets us out of the European Union, we haven't actually exited the European Economic Area, so we'd then be sitting in there, which we can, you know, you can sit in there probably indefinitely, unless we trigger that as well. So I think that comes later. As I understand it, that comes later in the year. But as long as we haven't done that, then we can sit in the European Economic Area a bit like
does
Norway.
That give us I was going to say, could you explain that Norway model slightly for us?
Yeah, well, the Norway model is they choose to not get involved in the politics of the European Union, and they sit in the European Economic Area, which is almost like a sort of an associate membership to a club, if you like, whereby they agree to abide by all the laws and they pay a membership fee. Quite a stiff membership fee. It's about two-thirds of what we would pay per head to still be involved and have the same rights as if you were a member into the European Area. But you do then have an ability to have controls over your certain elements of controls over your own immigration policy, which is a hot topic, and on negotiating with other countries' trade deals. But you do have to accept the four pillars. Freedom of movement will be the of labour movement will be the contentious piece. But we could sit there, you know, or we could just agree with our European partners that if we're not finished with negotiations to roll over, you know, for another month or another year. The notice period, and that again is just a subject to negotiation. And these things, you know, in the commercial world, Tim, these things are not. It's not unusual. You have a completion date for, you know, a contract that everyone, you know, swears by. You know, we're going to buy Marks and Spencers by such and such a date, and this is the terms of the deal. And you know, you trundle along, and the best one in the world, you fluff the date, but you agree to roll it over. Irritating, but necessary.
And in terms of fluffing things, is the what's your verdict now for Theresa May's future? Do you think she's going to stay at the helm finally, or do you think everything that's happened with the election and post has become so much of a distraction from what was all supposed to be about the Brexit election initially?
Well, I think to her benefit, she's got a party and a series of 300 odd MPs who do not want to fight another election. I don't think anyone's going to decapitate her. There's a period in history, the American War of Independence, where Earl Shelburne was put in a position of being the Prime Minister for 18 months or so to negotiate what became known as the Peace of Paris, which is the American independence. And he was totally unpopular. No one really wanted to do the job, and they kept him in there. And then, you know, he gets politically executed as soon as that job is done. And William Pitt then comes along and kind of saves the day. Now, maybe that's a parallel in history, where we've got someone who is essentially, she's there, she's Prime Minister. I mean, she did get the largest vote, Tory vote, you know, since 1979. You know, it's a phenomenal result in that respect, but she did not get the majority. But yeah, absolutely, no one's going to topple her, and I think she'll stay there. And she's said that she'll go when people want her to go, and I bet that will be, you know, the week after Brexit is concluded. So if she can hang on in there without by-elections eroding away and keeping the DUP on side, then she's there until after the Brexit departure in March 2019, and then I think you'll have a leadership contest.
Although that reduced majority may make life more difficult for her to get certain bills passed.
Yes, but so Tim, I think what the idea there is you've seen the 2 year parliament in effect now, i.e. not a Queen's speech next year. They're going to basically make this a Brexit parliament. This will be called in history the Brexit parliament, and that's why I think she'll go to the wire. And they will do as little legislation that's contentious as possible. I mean, in many respects, Tim, I think this might actually be a glorious parliament, because she will only be able to live by cooperation with other parties, which might not be a bad thing for UK politics, that they have to do compromise along the way, talk civilly to each other, get things done.
Well, that is pretty much how we started this interview, so it's probably a good place to end it as well. Cooperation and compromise.
And that's all we got time for this week, folks. Thanks ever so much for joining us for the Brexit Podcast. As I said at the start of the show, you can catch up with us on Twitter at Brexit Podcast or at Facebook too. The Brexit Podcast was brought to you by Tim Hemming, Jennifer Hahn and Warren Pohl, with theme music from Kevin MacLeod.